Right, oh, okay.
Back to the beginning.
Okay. Yeah, we could turn it off. Yeah, I'm surprised it did that, but I guess I didn't put it on pause at the last slide. Okay, perhaps we just... yes, please, yes. Just put sleep on the... put it to sleep by the apple, and... just a little further to the left is an apple sign. Yeah, thank you. And just go to sleep. Yeah, great. Thank you so much. So the Hunter College has given us a little, has had a little festival of Redux shows in its big Times Square gallery, which is, I think, the last show in that rather hot space. Hot in temperature, I mean, not in trendiness.
What did you mean?
It's physically very hot. I think that's why it's closing, because you know, one wants to lend their pictures to a hot gallery. They did an exhibition. They did a revisiting of the exhibition Conceptual Abstraction, which is actually a show I'd love to have been able to talk about, but alas, it closed some weeks ago. And they also have this historical show just down the road, their main campus of the Times Square show revisited. What do we make of this? This is the most of the three shows we're looking at, the most concerned with and faithful to an actual show, I mean, in much the way that the Lippard is to an actual book. Does it have any of the vibe, any of the energy, or is it just the wrong time, the wrong place to think about an art exhibition that took place in a much seedier Times Square in a ex-massage parlor?
Let's just spell out for the audience what we're talking about. There's a show, 1980, a bunch of artists get together pretty informally, take over a space in Times Square that was a former massage parlor, a big space, four floors, I think.
And a basement.
And a basement. And they and all their friends, there's almost nothing that prevents someone from showing in the show. There are no wall text, no wall labels, no names for artists. It's a real DIY community kind of effort. Between artists mostly in Tribeca and the East Village, I think. So real kind of alternative scene.
It was more or less organized by CoLab and the artists that were associated with CoLab. I think there were 100-plus artists, and it's true, it was very open-ended because that was the spirit of CoLab, although it was also co-organized with Fashion Moda, which was a South Bronx collective, and I was a little disappointed that they did not focus much on that contribution in the wall text or in the catalog. I also, you know, you think it's Times Square, so you think it would have been in their Times Square galleries. 12,000 square feet would have given it a lot more of the original energy, you know, of the show. It's not a massage parlor in the seedy, you know, 1980 era of Times Square. But the show was actually curated by a master's. It was came out of a thesis show. Project, basically. So that's interesting to think about to me, was that here was this artist, you know, young student in the Times Square studios, which are going to close. You know, urban revitalization is going on now in that area. I think that's why Hunter's closing those galleries. And in 1980, that revitalization was going on in the 70s in, you know, an urban revitalization in many cities.
Sort of the beginning of that New York.
Yeah, so I think that was, you know, it sort of explains to me maybe the genesis of the show, and I really appreciate that. You know, a student went to the trouble of interviewing a lot of these now forgotten artists and put together the show. That said, I think the show was... a little disorganized. You know, I don't know about you guys, but I could make neither a heads nor a tail of the checklist. It was a very confusing video.
But the original,
maybe
that's an homage to the spirit of the original, which would
an accidental homage, if nothing else.
I think videos just weren't up and running. And I don't think the checklist. I mean, you know, whatever. It was probably a small budget thing. And
any kind of critique of the DIY model of art making, the romantic notion of a bunch of artists saying, you know, let's put on a show, still seems incredibly popular, and no one seems to talk about the possible deprofessionalization of art making.
The Bruce art Bruce Hive Art Foundation is the living embodiment of that.
That's right, unchanged from earlier incarnations. Now, I lived for 10 years in Washington, D.C., where it's almost a disease, the notion that so long as a bunch of people get together and put the art on the walls, no matter how bad the art is, that's a good thing. Right? That there's this.
Or how good the art is, but how badly put together the show is.
Sure. That's, right. There's almost never a problem that the art's really great and the show stinks. I wish.
Yes.
Well, possibly, but I think it always needed to be questioned and has never been questioned enough. That is, it could have been not problematic even in 1980. I mean, but, among other things, how many important works of art actually come out of a show like this? There were some, and some good artists.
No, some serious artists, Tom Martinez,
Charlie Ahern, Wild Style, and the whole contribution.
Jenny Holzer.
Jenny Holzer, Kiki Smith, there's many.
In terms of the percentages, you'd probably get a as good a percentage as you get out of any big sort of group
but the
show.
Thing is, the thing is, if you look at, say, the Viennese Secession, those were artists who were boycotting the Academy, coming out of the Academy, doing things in a new way, okay? They didn't do it in a DIY. They got the most beautiful building in Vienna, almost, to house the Secession. And they set a new standard for how to do shows. So it's a new thing, isn't it, this romantic idea that if your artists are not a museum, you do it in a crappy way and it's more
authentic.
I think
Dada and Fluxus, you know, are the precursors to the do-it-yourself
style. They did it better. They did it better.
The Salon de Refusé, if you really want to go
That's
there. And they weren't as slick as the people who were showing the
Salon. Or Manet being the first to establish something outside of the Salon system. So, I mean, do-it-yourself has connotations now that I think come from this period, 1980, but I think it can be extended and understood.
But do you not think there's anything problematic? I mean, I originally was trained in the Renaissance, where it would have been ridiculous to imagine a non-professionalized artist, right? It would have been ridiculous to imagine an artist who wasn't entirely serious, who didn't have great training, all sorts of things. And this isn't an argument for skill, but it just seems to me that not questioning the notion that that's not a model we can have anymore, not questioning the romantic model seems a problem for
me. It seems to me.
Well, there's a lot of damage in smaller cities like Washington.
Well, we can't have it now, but if you look at the context then, we might have it if there's a real bust. Mm-hmm. And I hate to go back to the market, but this is exactly the kind of context in which they found themselves. I mean, 1980 is a situation in which the whole world is... New York's almost been... Drop Dead was when? 76, 78? Drop Dead in New York? Gerald Ford.
Yeah.
The Vietnam War has just ended. There isn't a lot of there is virtually no place for these young artists to go and show, never mind have a career. And New York's
and they didn't
pit.
Want to be part of and the gallery system. I mean, they were like many of the artists, you know, that precede them
they came
show.
Around to not wanting to be in. I mean, once they got enough it's doors true. Shut.
But
in
I think
face.
Blake's point is not that they're artists who take their fate into their own hands and organize their own show. It's that they do it in a shoddy way.
But let me finish the point. The point being that when they do sort of get up on their DIY horse, as it were, and put this show together, again, the context responds in the following way. There's a piece written by Jeffrey Deitch in Art in America that is very important. There's a piece written in the Village. There's two pieces written in the Village Voice, which at the time was a far more important publication than it is now, unfortunately for me. But it was the big event of the year, and in fact, it's been so big that we've been hearing about it, all of us, since 1980.
Jeffrey Deitch called it courageous.
Yes, he said that Times Square is New York's behavioral sink.
And Lucy Lepard had many issues with it because she thought that it just kind of
ripped off her people.
No,
it was a very political.
I think she thought that it was playing into the gentrification that was going on because developers were happy to have the artists come in and take over the space.
That's an interesting
and it is an inevitable problem with that sort of stance, absolutely. And I'm not arguing either with the fact that, you know, sometimes the do-it-yourself aesthetic produces, you know, shitty work that
it's
no
a form
one
of
wants to see again.
I think is Blake's
but
point.
It's a spirit and an attitude that has a force and that I think has been very important to, you know, contemporary art. If we think of contemporary art from
and I guess what I'm saying ultimately
is
the DIY thing translated from that moment in that context to one that's entirely flush. In which, again, everything's for sale.
And nobody had money then.
But there you go. Is a different animal. So yeah, the de-skilled movement, and there is such a thing. I'm sure you guys have probably heard of it. It's not a movement per se, but you hear this a lot. You know, the movement towards de-skilling art. In fact, the last Whitney Biennial was chock full.
Although that's a slightly different set of issues, because the reactionaries can also talk about de-skilling in a negative way. Right.
Yes and no. The attitude, I think, towards a lot of those young artists, and certainly from their galleries, is that work is DIY.
And it's much of the work, I think, is problematic.
And Christie Rupp
said
that she actually acknowledged that it was, you know, that this whole kind of punk attitude was this combination of self-indulgence and insurgence.
But
I don't think there was a complete, you know, lack of awareness that some aspects of that period in the DIY attitude, if you want to sort of confine it to that, was a little self-serving, navel-gazing kind of work, and that's problematic, right? But I still think it's not a deprofessionalizing.
I mean, it's funny you use the word punk aesthetic, which is one I've used in talking about it, and I suddenly thought, well, wait, actual punk rock was way more interesting than the DIY aesthetic of the Times Square show.
But you really don't like it.
What that
you don't like that show, you don't like the history
and punk
of it.
Punk came out
I'm
of the DIY aesthetic. You didn't need
important.
To know how to play an instrument. Anybody could play. That was, you know, the point. Fluxus was, you know, the real. I wish Fluxus had been sort of talked about more as a really important historical influence in Warhol, as well as this whole kind of anti-materialist, you know, anti-institution.
I guess
work that we're talking about and looking at in these exhibitions.
I guess there's a difference that Fluxus doesn't strike me as very romantic. It has a romantic quality. It certainly is bohemian in a sense. But
totally
it has,
romantic.
It has a core of genuine difficulty and complexity, it seems to me. It's not just the gesture. And I'm not convinced that this version of DIY, and again, it comes partly from my experience of having been in a number of small centers where the only model for art making is, in fact, basically exactly the model in this show. So there's been a pernicious influence of that model, it seems to me. And it gets a lot of people, lets a lot of people get away with making really terrible art. And if you complain about it, then you're the man, and then you're fighting what artists really should be doing. That is, this is the model for a lot of people of what artists should be doing. They should be making weird, funky stuff of old stockings that they found and putting them in an ugly.
Well, the show was meant. The show was meant to comment on what was going on, you know, economically at the time. And I think the parameters were the artist needed to discuss sex, money, and urban decay. So again, there was, you know, some kind of focus to the show. It wasn't just, you know, people did go in and do whatever they wanted to do, you know. But so there was, you know, aspects of that. But I think that just heightens the sense of unexpected and, you know, the energy that you get.
I mean, ultimately, it is different if it happens in New York in 1980 as opposed to Ottawa in 2009. It's just going to be.
I was actually thinking about Ottawa specifically.
There you go.
Windsor, Ontario is where I saw a painful example of it.
The worst do-it-yourself.
But name any town in North America with more than 100,000 people and you'll get. No, they have their version of the let's put on a show folks phenomenon, you know.
Well, sometimes actually documented doesn't look that different, so.
Don't know where to go with that one.
Okay.
But I'm really glad this show existed. I think this is incredibly important to examine the 1980, this moment.
Yeah, I wish they would have taken more time with it personally, and I obviously wish it would have taken place in the Times Square galleries.
That's not so close to Times Square. It's a good distance
from
Times Square.
Well, it's
42nd Street, 41st Street.
And 11. It's close enough.
You know, 41st and 11, yeah.
And yes. The original was, what, 41st and 7th,
and
I 7. Think. So.
Yes, it would have had but this was an attempt, actually, once you're in that room, down there at Hunter, you do, you know, the wallpaper, there's a regarding Warhol moment, the dollar bill wallpaper. There is also, I think, quite meticulous and sort of philological research into how the original had been installed, and the curators have made, put in energy to reconstitute that in
the
space.
There was good stuff in the vitrines.
Yeah, I liked the souvenir shop. There were some really great multiples that were included in that.
Unfortunately, not for sale.
Yeah, I know. I noticed there's no pr- price on anything.
Now, you know,
you're complaining about the market, and now you're complaining because
But multiples.
There's no market there.
I'd love to get one of Christy Rupp's rat T-shirts. I'm sure that you know you can get them at Printed Matter. I think so. You know, I mean, yes. But if, I mean, Hunter can't sell art. I'm sure.
It's no. Just, I guess, again, yes. I want us to address the issue of whether this isn't a travesty of the radical feeling of the 1980 show, that is, putting it into the Hunter College Gallery at Lexington and
68
is automatically travestying the work, making it impossible to actually experience the work in anything like a way that makes sense of the work.
Well, but
it's, in fact,
archival.
It's a history museum. It's another
archival.
History museum show.
No more than the Pergamon Altar in Berlin. I mean, that's the conundrum of a museum anywhere.
Sure.
Yes. Yes. So, before we bring in our audience, who must be bursting with comments and questions and queries and protests, let's try to we've looked at some detail at the shows in question. Although interestingly, we haven't homed in on specific objects that we felt we needed and wanted to talk about, which is interesting in itself. But the nature of the beast, I suspect. We've already actually began to throw up some of the basic problematics of canon formation through reconstituted shows. But museums, curators, what can and should they be doing to revise and remind and formulate a canon? And do we need a canon? What do we feel? It's just very general remarks on the basis of the three shows we've been looking at. What would the panelists like to see happening in museums?
I think I would have liked to have seen that Times Square show in a museum. You know, I mean, I think it's great. I wasn't aware of the fact that it was a student who'd done the curating.
Yeah,
and I think
it was
though I had exactly the same problems that you did. Yeah. I was going around with the checklist.
Top, bottom. I know.
South.
So confusing.
The curator was Carly Wurzelbacher.
It was also Shauna Cooper.
Her associate, yes.
No,
yes.
But in any event, you know, an admirable job because it, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. When you know that, it sort of mitigates the fact that it's a little bit messy. And, you know, some of the excerpts there in this catalog, there are statements from different artists that she interviewed. Some of them happen to be put on the wall. You don't know why. It's a little bit random. But to answer your question, if there wasn't a canon, what would artists have to react against? Mm-hmm. You know, I love the idea of constantly expanding and challenging the canon, but
you need a canon to do that.
Exactly. I don't think it's going to go away.
It's impossible. It's sort of impossible to imagine not having a canon at all. What would that mean? That you'd have an infinite interest in an infinite number of works? There'll always be a limited number of works to which you are paying attention. I'm not sure. I don't know how you do away with. I guess everyone could have their own canon, and you'd have no commonality of interest. But that seems unlikely.
Every show would be a Times Square show.
That's a terrifying thought.
So you really just didn't like the Times Square show at all?
No. You mean the original one or the revisited?
Either.
I think the revisited was an important historical exhibition that addressed something that I happen to think is problematic. But
I
that
see.
Doesn't mean that it shouldn't exist, you know, by any means.
It obviously would have been nice if it had equal footing with the other two shows, meaning that it had that it had been actually sort of folded into the a museum canon, as it was.
But do you think we agree that there are significant and interesting artists who did some very early work in the Times Square show? But do you think it could sustain the kind of museum attention of a couple of rooms of regarding Warhol?
I think.
I do
as well.
I mean, you could have done some real recreation.
Absolutely.
Then. You could have been more ambitious about. Although, on the other hand,
more artists could have been included. You know, I think the problem was there just wasn't the money to really do a proper.
It may be that a lot of the material's just gone, too. I've got a feeling that there's just not that much left of the actual stuff in the show.
But, you know, a lot of those people are alive.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a bump, sure, it's a budget thing.
I can't think it is just a budget thing. Or rather, let's be a little Marxist about it. Let's be Marxist about it. Why isn't there a budget for it? I mean, that's...
It's Hunter College, as Christian just said. I mean,
I don't think they
have the
money.
Okay, so
why doesn't the Met want to do Times Square show and leave Warhol to Hunter College?
Well, this probably wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been a student working on a thesis, and I think probably inspired by working in the Times Square galleries, or sorry, studios, and knowing they're going to close, and deciding she wanted to interview some of these early artists, and then suddenly deciding an exhibition would be a good idea, and getting some support from the school to do it, and probably the support was very limited financially.
Yes, the mechanics are not to patronize you in any way, but fairly obvious. But the point is this: I mean, I don't think that there are.
The answer to your question is because the Met has a different agenda, David.
I mean, the Met. Come on, I mean, the Whitney would probably have done this show if it had been presented to them and presented in a much more comprehensive, well-organized way.
In fact, it's true that a show actually we could also have thrown into the mix if we wanted to send our audience and ourselves to another show was the Around and About the Bowery show at the New Museum, which is actually art of a similar vintage to some of these people, and that's
a good analog.
That's okay. Let's now perhaps let's get our roving mic, and now's the time to address any of the three shows we've been talking about, or the meta issues of canonizing that these shows are.
Everyone's leaving. Bye!
Right, yes.
Well, if art is not a series of objects made over history, or a collusion of art and the market, then what is it?
Well, in between 1966 and 1972, it was a bunch of people trying to not make objects and collude with the market. So.
It was about the real world, about intersecting with the everyday or the notion of the everyday. You know, it was about a kind of anti-object or discrete object practice.
Yeah, and more recently, it's been about events, things that are not even on paper. And that managed to be sold anyway.
Yeah.
Well, and there's an argument to be made that, in fact, for, long before this period, in the 16th century, 15th century, whatever you want to say, it wasn't about objects freestanding to be appreciated in a museum setting, that the objects were completely folded into social practices of one kind or another, so that I think there are lots of models for what...
I think the answer comes from our... one of our artists. Art is a guy's name, isn't it? At the back.
Hi. I actually worked on the Lepard show, so I have some thoughts. I think in some way there's also a romanticization of the lack of objects during that period. So these artists colluded in their own terms with the idea of dancing that dance, right? So all of this material exists because they saved it and they used it and they displayed it quite bureaucratically and actually in an aesthetic that's quite similar to the show as it exists. If you look at the installations from January 1 through 31, for example, you have Adrian Piper as a secretary lording over this office space that has pieces of paper and documentations and a couple of books and a stain on the floor. And it's very, it's not a gallery, but it's a gallery type space in which you come in and have a phenomenological experience that's also intellectual, that also takes you through text pieces, etc. And so I think it's interesting because there is a romanticization of that period, that it was so radical, but they were immediately trying to figure out how to get back into the market, the contracts and these kinds of other kinds of distribution and other ways of imagining, but still with a complete eye to art history and a certain legitimation that, I think I love the radicalization and the utopian desire that a lot of the art comes from, but at the same time, I don't think they completely broke as much as they wanted to or thought they were, if you look back on it, and that's where, the show can stay quite close to the intentions, or the way the work was originally displayed, for example, without moving that far away. But what I was struck by, and I haven't had a chance to see the 80s show, is that seems to me the installation shots you showed quite far from the aesthetic of DIY and the energy of the Times Square show, as I understand it from my own research. And so that seems really like a moment where the division between being moved into an institution and what that would look like, or what how you would transpose that kind of energy of everybody's invited, everybody can do whatever they want, and bringing forward sex money and, you know, all of that. So I'm curious, sort of.
Perhaps the irony is that if Hunter had a bigger budget, they could have done a better job of making it look DIY.
Right.
Possibly. Yeah, you know, I think it's worth pointing out that, I mean, just as you said, that basically what a lot of the early conceptualists basically sort of plotted out was an anti-aesthetic. Right.
Well,
and it's an anti-aesthetic that's actually sort of worked its way around to becoming quite aesthetic.
I think it was quite aesthetic, you know? And, from the start. There's a look.
Yes.
There was always a look to
what
you like.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
It was
yes.
a position within the field of aesthetics.
Exactly.
And
Joseph Kossuth spent a lot of time and energy getting the right type font for his anti-aesthetic statement.
We had to order a specific color gray from his studio to make that
right,
piece.
Right.
You know, so, yeah.
Yeah.
You were talking about, do you mind taking the microphone and telling, apparently an argument I made was specious, and I'm just interested in, honestly, genuinely interested, about why 16th century art, I was arguing 16th century art, in fact, isn't part of a series of objects necessarily.
Yeah, but you were talking about them being embedded in a social practice, which is true, but it was a religious practice.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are still orphans of that, actually, that connection between art and religion. It's been two centuries now that art has severed its ties with religion, and when we speak of the autonomy of art, we should never forget that it began with the autonomy from religion.
Mm-hmm.
And now the market, you know, for utopian Marxist thinkers, utopia or politics has taken the place of religion. That was Walter Benjamin's
mm-hmm.
position, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And now the market has taken over everything,
mm-hmm.
indeed. Now, I don't know. Now, regarding the market, I have very mixed feelings about it, to say the least. But I agree with David that we should not systematically glue together the word pleasure and the word market, because that's not what it's all about. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I have many, many artist friends, and I wish them to be able to live from their work. So how could you live from your work if there is not a market?
Mm-hmm.
What we should be saying, I think, more forcibly today is about the perversion of the market.
Of course.
And that the market is attempting to set the canon, and that canon is wrong.
That the market gets it wrong.
I didn't see any of the shows that you were talking about, but I'm going to see a couple of them tomorrow, but I did tour Chelsea this afternoon, and it was absolutely appalling to see such very, very good artists, and in one case I would even say a great artist, I'm talking about Ed Rocher, falling off the cliff, and it's not the fiscal cliff,
yeah.
Like that with his show at Gagosian, which is so saddening. Like good old Greenberg used to say, an artist goes over. Well, he went over with that show. And the Charles Ray show is of the same, cut from the same cloth. More empty space to make the show look, the art look
more
impressive,
precious.
But there's not much substance. And the Glenn Ligon show,
market,
another
possibly.
Very good artist, but you put 15 neon pieces by Glenn Ligon and nothing else, and it becomes pretty objects, totally meaningless, and who is behind that? Who is manipulating? I mean, those, obviously we have generations of art dealers who do not have the education that Leo Castelli had, or Ileana Zonabend, or those dealers who were there when the conceptual artists were around.
Well, I think if we... If all of us here wind up, maybe with the exception of David, are banging on about the market, it's precisely because of that. Because I think we wish to make a significant distinction between what the market does constructively and the way in which the market is perverting the process these days.
Well, when you have something resembling a genuinely free market, then you can get, I believe, an invisible hand. Because when you go around Chelsea, okay, you got the big players doing what they're doing, but there are, and that's why I feel Chelsea is just such a precious resource, and it's so tragic. I mean, one of the reasons we have done historic shows this evening is because so many of the shows we were wanting to include in the regular way were postponed or cancelled or washed out, literally. But I've always maintained that collectively, the Chelsea galleries, or galleries wherever they are, collectively, are an incomparable museum of contemporary art. And that that if you put them all together and then compare them to what the contemporary galleries are at MoMA or the Guggenheim or the Whitney, the Invisible Hand of the Market is a much more judicious curator than the curators. That you go around those galleries and you pick what you want, and that is a better cross section of living art.
You're saying dealers are better curators? I don't agree with that at all.
I'm not saying dealers are. I'm saying
that they're the ones that are putting the art in the gallery.
It's the accumulation. If you had six dealers, it would be a nightmare. But the fact that you have 350 means that somehow between them. And you can walk into every one of them for free, which you can't unless you're a critic or a student at MoMA or the Met. I think it's just an amazing and incredible resource, and I have much better exposure to living art in Chelsea galleries than I most often do in the leading museums.
Then we should all be grateful for it, but I wouldn't be looking for the Invisible Hand of the Market, to be looking for the Hairy Hand of the Market.
Exactly. Where are we now?
Any questions on other topics, on works of art? Or
yes.
The shows? I'd love to know what people might have thought about any of the shows. Mm-hmm.
Well, this isn't a question exactly, but I wondered a little if a contemporary parallel to the Times Square show might be graffiti artists who also are working outside the gallery system and not worrying about where to put their work up. And that just occurred to me, so.
Well, I think they've been in the gallery system. I think Jeffrey Deitch sort of, you know, made a particular.
Museums.
No, absolutely.
But the weird thing about the graffiti, world of graffiti and street art is it's the most conservative of all artistic movements, right? It has an incredibly limited number of things it wants to say. It tends to be virtually apolitical or not politically active in any with any real agency. It's a very strange, the notion that it still represents.
I think it's evolved quite a lot since 1980 and, you know, an emphasis on tagging and territory. And, I mean, I think it's, I don't agree. I think that graffiti art is not conservative at all these days.
Do you mean graffiti art or street murals?
Well,
are they the same thing?
They're not the same.
I don't think they're the same thing, no. So are you sure?
But I think that street murals can still be graffiti-esque and, mm-hmm. you know, you see very organized compositions, if you want to, you know, describe them that way, that are being done by very interesting artists. I see all over the city.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the last, 15 years.
Well, I think Jane will have to take Blake and those who want to on a guided tour. Let's have one or two more comments, if we could. The gentleman here and then the lady there.
When you were speaking about the do-it-yourself form of art, it occurred to me that after the church art, then the revolt against that comes, and you've got, you know, a Picasso or Matisse or earlier doing this soul-searching individual art thing that ultimately becomes the do-it-yourself. I mean, it transmutes into a do-it-yourself kind of art and punk art, and as far away from any real anyone can do it kind of art. And that leads me to the question of if this is a final phase of that we're living through now, where everyone can become an artist and there is no professional standards, as you suggested, or whatever you want to call that, then is the future someone like Andy Warhol, who moves into a factory art and, you know, something that isn't this individual thing, but becomes a group effort, and I don't know what, but that's whatever Andy Warhol was basically trying to say.
Business art.
And I think that is part of the future, and that's been interesting. There's been some good business art done, I think, that's been genuinely interesting, more interesting than you know, the outpourings of all the Garretts in Windsor, Ontario. So I think that's, if it's not part of the future, it's part of the present in an interesting way. And I would say in an interesting way.
I think it's...
But we, yeah, it's been Christian and I have disagreed about this.
I don't think it's interesting at all this minute. I think it's the least interesting thing happening.
We'd have to have
another argument about why Damien Hirst is important right this minute as opposed to not.
Been there, done that.
We have.
And Coons.
Who's done obviously interesting work, and so has Damien Hirst. But, mm-hmm. but again, you know, Andy won, or he's winning, and or at least the last Andy.
Exactly.
Although I think that the last Andy is looking better and better. The last Andy, for me, is looking like one of the most courageous, interesting, strange Andys.
Really?
Yeah, no, I go to bat in big time for Andy on the Love Boat. I think his greatest work of art was when he appeared on the Love Boat.
The Imelda Marcos Andy, the Love Boat Andy,
I'm going to bat for him all the way. Some other night.
Yes.
Yes, I think another night on late Andy. can we...
Yeah. What's that Hannah Arendt line about the banality?
The
of
lady
evil?
Is the, going the, to
this,
speak.
The evil of banality in this case with Laurel. Right.
So I just wanted to pose a question in terms of DIY and what's going on today with dematerialized art objects in terms of net art. And so in terms of canonization, too, what is your take on Tumblr blogs or artists who are now forming these different groups or doing social network art or, you know, Rhizome's Art Base? And I'm just interested because it seems like now, you know, the Lucy Lepard book also served as an exhibition. So now websites serve as exhibitions. And what do you think about that?
I think it's an interesting, hopeful phenomena that, you know, it's going to take some time for the sort of much more staid art world to really digest and figure out how to deal with and ultimately figure out how to sell. I think that's still a problem.
I would question that the virtual is actually related to the dematerialized. It's only dematerialized in the sense that its material base has a physical... dissemblance to a traditional crafted object, but it's actually people using what's actually our new material base as the vehicle. For.
Sometimes, not always, but sometimes.
Also using MegaBots, and so
using what?
Ways.
Sorry.
Yeah. So they're 3D printing.
Ah.
Oh, right. So MegaBot is one that's very kind of popular right now, and so a lot of artists that I know for years who are doing net art or doing generative art. Are now finding a way to create objects so that they can actually function in the market.
Exactly. And, yeah. Well, that's what I mean. You know, I think it's going to...
3D printing is a big thing now. So you build these objects virtually with these 3D programs, and you print them out as sculpture.
Let's just remember for a minute, though, to get back onto the market, which we all want to do so badly, is that there's an assumption in this room and in this country, in fact, which took me rather by surprise when I came here 10 years ago, that the only funding model for art is, in fact, the market, that that's the only thing that exists. But there are lots of countries. Canada has a lot of good art that's funded through arm's-length funding bodies. That's not an impossible model. As a society, we
can
decide.
Except the NEA is virtually non-existent. Well, so, you know, right. It is...
In this country, yes, but you go to Scandinavia...
Of course, all over Europe.
So it's not... People...
Yeah, that's true. That's an interesting alternative model. And that's a do-it-yourself kind of... approach as well.
I think actually
we have one more question and then we close.
I think we might just let it rest there, but thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. See you in the new year. Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was very good.